Okay, so our revels are going to continue before they're over at the end of these 2 hours. Since we are a somewhat smaller group than usual, probably because of the holidays, I wonder if I can persuade the people who are sitting on this side to come and join us over here. If it's not too much trouble, I think it would be more communal if we could, and probably easier for Larry and Mel to do the 50-yard dash with their... Good. Should have done this long ago, don't you think? Thank you all very much. So again, just to remind you of what our sequence is, today we're going to talk about the Tempest. On the 2nd of January, right after the break, there will be a plenary discussion where you're supposed to come with questions and protests and suggestions and thoughts and preoccupations. And they'll also will segue seamlessly into a kind of review for the exam. And the exam will be the following week, is that right? On the 9th, in this very space.
Yes.
So...
Standard time.
For folks who are coming in late, we're going to try to organize ourselves in smaller space, please, because we're a smaller group today. So I would be grateful. Larry, maybe I can station you at the door and you can kind of steer people just so we can get rolling. Would be great. Thank you very much. So, The Tempest. Conventionally regarded as, you know, Shakespeare's last play, his farewell to the stage. As you know, if you have read my chapter, which I hope you have, it is none of these things. We're going to try to move everybody into the middle here. Yeah, actually into the middle. Yes. Right. If you want an end seat, whoa, careful. We can put you over here. If you've read my chapter, then you will know that this is not true, that Shakespeare and his company produced at least one more single-authored play, Henry VIII, or All Is True, that there are other plays that Shakespeare seems clearly to have collaborated in producing. He doesn't retire from the stage at the moment when this play is finished. His death comes several years later in 1616. And in fact, what we have in this notion that the play itself is Shakespeare's farewell to the stage is a kind of cultural fantasy that we have produced because we cannot bear to lose him, and so we would like him to be able to say goodbye to us. Nonetheless, there is some goodbye saying and some hello saying in this important play, this really crucial and extremely powerful play, a play that is full of recognitions, refindings, startings anew, and confrontations with mortality, not only the mortality of the protagonist, Prospero, but also the notion of figures outside the play who have died, the fantasy that Ferdinand's father has died. The play is full of intimations of both mortality and immortality, and it handles these things with extraordinary grace and beauty. This is justifiably and consistently one of Shakespeare's most admired plays. It's certainly a play that I very greatly admire myself. It's a play that has gone through many different strong periods of interpretation. And one of the things that I think that we should do in talking about this play is to review for ourselves the modes of interpretation that have seized upon the play and made it their own. And I will also want for us to look at some of the particular passages in the play that are so, again, justifiably moving and beautiful and celebrated and quoted out of context, whether it's by T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland or in various other places. And we'll also want to look at the major characters in the play, because after the other three romances that we looked at, which had a vast landscape, the moving from place to place to place, huge time span, with two of them having in the middle of them a space of 14 years and 16 years, many characters, armies, nationalities, personalities flowing through these plays. And here I'm speaking again about Pericles, Cymbeline, and The Winter's Tale. Here we have a play that's extremely compact in its personnel, very compact in its location, very compact even in its time span. What's happened in this play to the growing up gap that we noticed in the other romances, the necessity for the second generation to grow up? What's happened to it here? Happened before the play begins. We saw that in Cymbeline, but we nonetheless, Cymbeline was full of you know, losses that took place in real time, so to speak. Here the losses, most of them, although not Ferdinand's supposed loss, have already taken place. What's the time span? 12 years. 12 years. Does that mean that Miranda is 12? How do we know that? She was three. Splendid. Okay, very good. So she is in the Juliet young marriageable age. She is a young woman who has never really, almost never known anything. She has a dim memory of where she came from. But she is one of the few, as she thinks of it, inhabitants of this island. Maybe let's set the personae first, and then we can talk about the effects of the play. So the play begins in medias res, so to speak. Something happened 12 years ago that we're going to find out about in retrospect by a conversation. Who's in the play? I was going to say who's on the island, but who's in the play? Who are the characters whom we will encounter? Yes?
On the island now you have Prospero, you have his daughter Miranda, you have Caliban, and you have Ariel,
right,
the non-human.
Not only non-human, but how many of these characters is Ariel directly available? Who
Prospero.
Sees him? Prospero.
Yeah.
Prospero. So that Ariel is we see him, or her. There was a long tradition at the end of the 19th century in which Ariel was played by a woman. I've seen productions in which Ariel is played by a male gymnast. It's an acrobatic role. It's a dancing part. But not everybody encounters Ariel directly. Prospero does, and the audience does. And that tells you something about the angle of incidence into the play, the degree to which we are, you know, part of the Prospero world. Ariel, indeed. And these are the current inhabitants of the island. Who has lived on the island previously? Sycorax. And who is Sycorax? Caliban's mother. What does she look like? Sorry? How do you know?
They tell us that she's ugly, but I don't remember the language.
The foul witch Sycorax, who with age and envy was bent into a hoop, the blue-eyed hag, says who?
Prospero.
So one thing to, I mean, it's not that I'm telling you that Sycorax was actually, you know, a movie star, this is hearsay. This is all reported information, Sycorax, as it's important to keep underscoring, is outside the boundary of the play. She is the dispossessed former occupant of the island. She's female rather than male. She is also a witch, the way Prospero is a witch or a magician or a sorcerer, but she does not get to speak for herself. She's outside the boundaries of the play, and the degree to which she is demonized or described in these negative terms this is the language of, dare we say it, the conqueror or the dispossessor or the successor or the winner. This is how the people who have replaced her on the island describe her. We don't have any contrary information. Caliban doesn't say, "Oh, but she was beautiful." We don't. It's not that. But we do have an interested population that describes her as unfit in various ways, or malevolent in various ways. Well, do we know anything about any actions that she performed while we had her? Yes.
She imprisoned Ariel inside a tree.
Aha! Uh-huh. What kind of tree?
I don't remember.
A pine tree. Pine tree. I mean, not that it matters, but or maybe it does. But inside a pine tree. Why? We know why. Anybody know why? We learn why? Speculations as to why.
He also was able to do magic and in some sense compete with her.
Well, he's a sprite, he's a spirit, so we could say that, you know, that there's a, if we wanted to allegorize it, we could say that this is a life denying or it's a controlling situation. It's hard to say. Thank you. That's okay. That's okay. So Sycorax imprisons Ariel in the pine tree. Is that worse than what Prospero does?
It's similar in that she imprisoned him and Prospero has enslaved him. And it's the same amount of time. It's 12 years.
Right. Now, enslaved is a tough word. Is it used in the play? Who uses it?
Ariel uses it. Several people use it at different times, but Prospero calls Caliban his slave.
Caliban, yes. Right.
And so but Ariel's always begging for his freedom, so he's enslaved in his own way.
There's an analogy to be drawn here, but I don't remember, maybe other people will correct me, I don't remember that the word slave is used with respect to, yes, Ariel.
Ariel repeatedly refers to Prospero as master.
As master, yes, indeed. Indeed, but there, I mean, for example, there's a master among the shipmen. There's a bosun master. You could be the master with a servant rather than a master with a slave. You could be a master with a mistress. There would be many different ways of being a master without being a slave master, per se. Certainly, Prospero controls him, employs him. He consistently asks for his freedom. There is a tremendous analogy between that and Caliban's request for freedom. But I don't remember in the text that the word slave is used. Servant, yes, exactly, servant. Now, this, you may think that this is a distinction without a difference. You may think that this is just, you know, we like Ariel better than we like Caliban, or Prospero likes Ariel better than he likes Caliban, and so the word is used differentially. Nonetheless, the tasks that Ariel gets to perform are different from the tasks that Caliban gets to perform. What kinds of tasks does Ariel perform? Enchantments, okay. Like what?
He's the one that causes the ship to be tossed at sea.
Causes
he separates
okay.
all the characters so that none of them know each other is alive.
Right.
And he also causes the entire crew of the ship to be enchanted for the duration of the story.
Right. Yes.
And then at various other points, he causes characters to fall asleep.
To fall asleep,
right?
That's right. To be at one point, Ferdinand is frozen in his tracks. He's enchanted. He cannot move. The banquet with the several strange shapes entering, bringing a banquet. The music, the island that's full of music, that's so remarkable to Caliban. One of the most beautiful passages in the play. This is Ariel's music. Ariel is the musician. He is playing the music. So, music. What elements do we associate with Ariel? Air. What are the four elements? Remind me. Earth, water, fire, and air. So air, fire, Ariel. Earth, water, Caliban. Too simple? Yes. But this is a very elemental play. This is a play that is so sophisticated and so sure of itself that it can mobilize all of these great Renaissance cliches and all these great Renaissance set texts and set pieces and make them do something very special. It's a remarkable play. The economy of this play, the brilliance of this play, the way in which it boils things down to things that are very elemental, is what has given rise, among other things, to the sets of interpretations that we'll talk about in a second. So Ariel and Caliban, there's an analogy and a disjunction between them. Caliban also enslaved, abhorred slave, always? This is history on the island? No, why? Yes, please.
He was nurtured by Prospero until he tried to rape Miranda.
How do we know?
They tell us.
Okay, again. No reason to doubt it. Oh-ho, would it have been done? Would I people the isle with Calibans? There's certainly a sense that he, you know, he doesn't deny it. But again, the accusation, or rather the description of what took place. This is like date rape, you know, that he said, she said. I mean, the description of this as a violent act, as an unwanted act, as an act that deserved punishment and that deserved to move him from the state of playmate and favored second child into this enslaved state in which, what kind of work is he doing now? Menial work. There's wood enough within. He's carrying the wood. What else does he do?
Brings the water.
Yeah, he is supplying the necessities of life.
He helps them survive.
Yes.
But it's almost as if his act was amoral. When you hear him talk about it, he's not even apologetic. It's almost as if he was meant to do that and he didn't know how else to be.
Well, and indeed, we hear something about his education, don't we? I mean, who has been his principal source of education?
Prospero.
What has Prospero taught him?
Through his books, to be civilized.
Him astronomy, to how to name the bigger light and how the less. Taught him language. Taught him but Caliban himself did a little teaching. He's the naturalist. Here are the berries. Here's the fresh isles and the fertile water and so forth. That there's a kind of exchange that goes on. While Prospero is busy doing, you know, big science, so to speak, he's not doing the sex ed lecture. He's not there's no sense in which he is training Caliban up to be himself, to be a suitor, courtier, a gentleman, exactly. Think about The Winter's Tale and about that wonderful moment when they decide the shepherd and the clown are given titles and money, and the clown says, "See, I'm now a gentleman born," because the phrase "gentleman born" is one phrase to him. He doesn't understand that gentleman and gentleman born are two different things. So the Caliban, who actually is a queen's son, is not brought up as the inheritor of the isle, but rather as somebody who is taught certain sets of things, but not other kinds of things. But he is taught language, and that becomes crucial. In his own estimation, what's the effect of his having been taught language? You taught me language, and my profit on it is? I know how to curse. Why? Is that because of his nature? That's what Prospero says, and Miranda too, one on whose nurture could never stick. Is he just bad? He's just bad? Bad seed? Figure of evil? Please.
From his perspective, wouldn't it be that he's been put to hard labor and doing all this menial work and being treated as a slave? Which is enough reason to curse those who impose those conditions on him.
Yes, and behind you, please.
Yeah, that also, love was withdrawn from him. He was loved at first, and then no longer.
Right. This is partly a sort of tale of adolescence, too. I mean, there are many, many ways of allegorizing this play, and many ways of appropriating it into our own time as allegorization. If you ask historians of the Renaissance, they will tell you there's no such thing as adolescence in the Renaissance. Indeed, if you remember, again, the very wise shepherd in The Winter's Tale, who says, "I wish there were no time in life between, you know, a certain age and 23, because all the time in between is just fighting and disputation and so forth." That's the sort of little adolescent moment described, that if you think of the shepherd as the sort of the Dr. Phil of The Winter's Tale, that in this case, we have a Caliban who, again, off stage, and we don't quite see it because we don't have that sense that they're in that same moment, has reached this point of rebellious adolescence and behaves against the father surrogate. Yes, please.
It's also, I think, worth noting, it's a stage of adolescence that begins with his awakening sexuality when he first attempts to.
Right. And indeed, this is often the case in the plays that we have looked at, in the plays that are in the first half of the Shakespeare's career as well, that what causes a sundering between parent and child is the awakening of desire, whether it's Juliet's preference for Romeo over the County Paris, or Rosalind falling in love with Orlando in As You Like It. In all of these plays of adolescence, and there are many of them, or indeed Florizel and Perdita falling in love with one another, and as they think, going against the wishes of the father Polixenes, who only comes back into the fold when he discovers this is actually a princess and not a shepherdess. But these rebellions are almost always moments of sundering from the parental bond and a going out into the world and the beginning of another kind of narrative. And indeed, in this case, it is very unvarnished. It clearly is sexual desire. It's not. Caliban doesn't. The figure probably we should compare him to is Cloten in Cymbeline, where again, it's a kind of a desire mechanism that Cloten causes beautiful music to be sung. Caliban is a consumer of beautiful music. He likes the twangling of instruments, that sound that he can't identify because he can't see Ariel. But in fact, the story that we are told of the offstage, again, negative event that took place between or upon with Caliban and Miranda is a violent event, not a courtship. It's not that he brought her flowers. It's not that he wrote poems to her, that he did attempt the chastity, to violate the honor of my child, is what Prospero says. Again, he's an interested father. It's not that I want to sow doubt in your minds about what actually happened. I just want to remind you that these are off-stage events, that the story of Sycorax is an off-stage event, the story of the attempted rape of by Caliban of Miranda is an off-stage event. What else is an off-stage event in this play? Excuse me. What else happens off-stage, either before the play begins or around in the surround?
The usurpation of Prospero's kingdom by his brother.
Indeed. Indeed, and this happens before the time span of the play begins, and often also happens in a different place. Where?
Milan.
In Milan, yes, which is pronounced Milan in this play, just because of the scansion in Milan. Yes. yes, please.
Arabelle's marriage.
I want to talk about that, but let's stay with the. The usurpation, too. No, that's crucial, and that was actually what I was thinking of, but let's just hang on to that for a second and go back to the usurpation of the dukedom just to flesh it out a little bit. Why does... Who usurps the dukedom from Prospero? Antonio. And Antonio is his brother, right. Is he wrong to do so?
Prospero wasn't governing. He was into his magic.
Into the magic.
Right. He prefers his books. He neglects the governance of the state, that he is in his study instead. The opportunity presents itself for usurpation. Again, it's not as if everybody says, oh, it's great, really much better to have Antonio ruling. But Prospero is like King Lear, unburdened, crawling toward death, like that he is ignoring the issue of state. And he's wrapped in secret studies. He's enraptured by the study of magic. And magic in this period encompasses a very wide range of things. It is not only doing tricks or playing tricks. Magic, science, and religion are terms that are very much imbricated in one another. In this period, the evolution of the notion of science develops from the notion of magic, of natural theology, of understanding how the world works, of commanding. Because again, if you don't understand how the wind works, you could think that a sailboat is magic. So that it's partly a matter of who understands and who doesn't understand how natural forces work, and who understands and doesn't understand how math works and how language works. Out of this period will come a practice that will come to be called science, a word that literally means knowledge or knowing. And out of this, and will come a kind of rationalization of science and a certain kind of notion of science as a set of practices. But in this period, these categories are very fluid. It isn't until quite a long time after this, for example, that alchemy is thought of as distinct from chemistry. Alchemy is the immediate parent of chemistry, and in this period, not distinct from it. So that when we hear that Prospero is a magician, I think we need to have that, or that he deals with secret studies. I think that we need to have the broadest possible picture of what that means, that this is not merely the kind of thing that we see Ariel performing on the island with the disappearing banquet and so forth. The study is really the study of how to control the universe and how to understand the universe. And this is both noble and dangerous, and it's also extremely preoccupying. It's preoccupying to the extent that he neglects then the affairs of state, and his brother Antonio usurps the dukedom. How does he get rid of Prospero? Sets him adrift in a little leaky boat. With a leaky little daughter, right? Okay, so we the a cherubim thou wast that did preserve me. That's, I think, what the text says. Because she says, of course, that, now again, remember the completely artificial exposition at the beginning of this play. They have been together on this island for 12 years. Now, maybe he never told her this story before, because why should he need to know it before? Because something's about to change. The play begins in medias res. There's the shipwreck. And again, many of you have seen this play in the theater. It's fabulous the way this play begins. Because you're in the middle of this storm and the shipwreck, and you hear the clanging, and it's the people are shouting, and things are very distinct, indistinct, sorry. And hierarchy is gone. I mean, this whole, remember the, again, the scene in The Winter's Tale, when the clown is on the shore watching the shipwreck, and he's talking about the shipwreck and the poor souls and so forth, and he's also watching the Antigonus being torn apart by the bear, and how the Antigonus cried out that his name was Antigonus, a nobleman, but the bear paid no attention to the fact that he was a nobleman and ate him anyway. Now we're in the middle of that shipwreck, so to speak, and again, there's no distinction of class or rank. Everybody is in the same boat. Literally. And everybody is in the same storm. And who, in fact, is in that storm that is coming toward the island? Who has been ensnared in this storm that Ariel has made happen at Prospero's command? Sorry? Who? No, it's all these Neapolitan and Melanesian dignitaries who are part of the Prospero story. The Prospero story of the past, and also the Prospero story of the future, because we get not only Antonio the brother, but Alonso the king of Naples, and his son Ferdinand the prince of Naples, and there's a plot in view. This is the good suitor as opposed to the bad suitor. And pretty soon we'll find a third suitor arrives on the island to make this even more explicit. So the offstage is this action which precipitates where we are right now. I mean, there's a sense in which this island that Prospero is on is just or entirely his own mind. That's where he withdrew. That's where he went. He went into his study, the place with his books. He went into his mind and into the notion of the elements and how he could control them and so forth. And there's a sense in which he has journeyed or been shipwrecked on a place that is the equivalent of that psychic space that he was in before. It's a place of possibility. It's a place of elemental distinctions in which those elements that he might in his magic place be playing with are personalized by Ariel and by Caliban. We could say that it's a laboratory. We could say that it's a place of experimentation. We could say that it's a place in which both human and material or elemental experiments will take place. But historically, it's an island where? Where is this island? Why do you laugh?
Because it's variously attributed to lots of different islands, even Jamaica. But it's most likely an island that's just north of Africa in the Mediterranean.
And when you say most likely,
For the story.
In terms of what we know about where they're coming from and... yes. Okay, good. Over here, please.
Well, they're coming back from the wedding in Algiers.
Yes.
Which is referred to as Angier, I believe.
Argier.
And so presumably they're going back to Italy. So they're somewhere in the Mediterranean.
Right. It seems as if this is a Mediterranean island, but this is a perpetual question for Shakespeareans who have these large concepts to worry about. Is the play a New World play or an Old World play? Is this island, because some of the flora and the fauna, the business about the still-vexed Bermudes, the Bermuda Triangle, this is the Bermuda Triangle play. The play about sort of the ship that gets lost, the people that get lost, the things that are never heard of again because of this kind of magical set of vectors in the atmosphere. There's a sense in which this apparently perfectly clear location is also perfectly unclear, that there are enough confusing clues thrown in here just to make you say, wait a second, why are there Bermuda winds here near Algiers? And you could say, Shakespeare is not a naturalist, he doesn't know how to read maps, he's using two mixed sources or so forth, or you could say this is inadvertent genius. This works spectacularly well to make this the quintessential island in the quintessential body of water, having to do with the quintessential set of enslaved or incarcerated populations. Certainly, Europeans have often read this play as a play about Algeria or about the European-African relations. On the other hand, as you probably know, the play has been rewritten by Latin American, South American, Haitian, Martinican writers, New World playwrights and poets and essayists in the 20th century, in the late 19th century, as their story, as the story of their enslavement or their hopes or their necessity of them separating from North America or from white colonization or from England or from whatever, or from France, whatever the colonizing power was thought to be. So that it seems to be clear, only it's not quite clear. And the not quite clearness, this was a topic that, in fact, the Shakespeare Association of America, which is the annual conference of Shakespeareans, always takes place in a kind of nice and interesting place. Several years ago, I think you go to this meeting, took place in Bermuda. And so on a completely horrible rainy weekend in Bermuda in February, and I kept saying to the president of the Shakespeare Association, who was a friend of mine that year, I said to her, it rains in Bermuda. And, oh, no, it'll be great in Bermuda. So there we all were in a hotel in Bermuda, raining like mad. It did clear the next day. But one of the topics of this particular meeting of the Shakespeare Association was, is The Tempest a New World play or an Old World play? To which the answer is yes. And there are vigorous proponents of both, and for the reasons that you guys have mentioned, absolutely, that's one kind of argument. There's another. Depends upon what you want it to mean, kind of. It depends upon what you want to use it for. It depends upon what story you think it's ultimately telling or what story your audience is receiving. But indeed, 12 years ago, in another place, there was the usurpation. In other words, Prospero, for all that he is deeply aggrieved and has been used ill, there's some, as with King Lear, shouldn't give away your kingdom. Shouldn't stop being king before you have to. So also Prospero here again shouldn't neglect the affairs of state if you want to stay duke, which maybe you don't. And again, if you know the whole wide scope of Shakespeare plays, you'll know that they're often two brothers, Hamlet, old Hamlet and Claudius. The As You Like It, Duke Senior and Duke Frederick. Think of some others, some other cases in which there are two fathers, so to speak, rather than one. Think of any more of these? There are lots of them. And here too we have it's as if the character splits in half. It's as if you have the Duke who deals only with affairs of state and is rather Machiavellian about it, and the Duke who is of higher mind but also not paying a lot of attention to affairs of state. And that's the part of Prospero, so to speak, that comes to the island. So now, sorry, did you more on this? Sorry, please.
I thought more of Measure for Measure than King Lear as a reference for this
play. The abdication of, yes, it's a very good example. It's a very good example. That the old fantastical Duke of Dark Corners, that the Duke begins by saying, something is rotten in the state of Vienna, and I can't fix it because it's partly my fault. I have let the laws grow lax, and so I can't myself enforce them. I'm going to have my substitute Angelo do so. Now, whether that turned out just to be a ruse in order to test Angelo or not, hard to say. But precisely, some basically virtuous person in a, and it very, very similar, that there's some sense in which, what was his set of preoccupations? What was he doing instead? You have any instinct about this at all? Yes, please.
Well, the Duke was sort of running around and manipulating things behind the scenes and moving the characters around, which is kind of similar to what Prospero winds up doing.
That's what he does, yes, in the play, absolutely. That this notion that this Duke is a playwright or that Prospero is a playwright, that's actually absolutely what happens in the course of the play. Do you have any instinct about why, before the play begins, so to speak, what he was doing instead of running the government well? Partying, you think? He says, you know, the dribbling dart of love will never pierce this complete bosom. He's not interested in love and sex, even though he actually is interested in love and sex. So we don't have, I think, the sense that he's a party boy, particularly. Anything else?
I think wasn't he just preoccupied with being too kind, and things got out of hand because he couldn't bring himself to enforce the laws?
He's too mild,
so it's
perhaps.
It's not that he actually did anything, it's that he just let things go.
Hard to say. He's more, I mean, if you imagine the Hamlet of the early scenes of Hamlet as the king, rather than there's some sense which he thinks too much, whatever. He's not obeying the laws. And one of the things that dukes often do in Shakespeare plays that have dukes in them is to first lay down the law and later mitigate the law. They often come out at the end of the play, as happens in Measure for Measure, as happens in Comedy of Errors, and says, well, you know, don't worry, I pardon you, you can have mercy rather than the law, and so forth, so that the Duke is often in that position of first being the person who has to enforce and lay down the law and impersonate the law, mortality and mercy in Vienna, and also the one who can change it. That's certainly exactly what happens in Measure for Measure. Here, too, we have a Duke who has some choices to make. Clarabelle. Tell me about Clarabelle, please.
Clarabelle was Alonso's daughter, and she is forced into an arranged marriage that she really doesn't want to.
Why doesn't she want to marry whoever it is she's marrying?
Well, I think he was black.
He's an African. He's an African.
Yeah. And she didn't want to go there. And I think that, I don't know whether I'm just intuiting this, she didn't want to give up the power in Naples as well.
I don't know that we know that. I mean, this only comes in this question of who is the, you know, the king is the king is dead. So who is the next heir of Naples, Clarabelle?
Right.
But she, you know, she'll never hear that her father's dead because right. She's miles and miles and miles away.
So if Ferdinand is dead, you know, as it's postulated or fantasized at one point by Alonso, theoretically she could not take over the power and that it would go to Antonio.
Or to Sebastian.
Yeah.
Sebastian the wicked brother
right.
of the king Alonso. So we have this family of Alonso the King and his daughter Clarabel and his son Ferdinand. Clarabel, as you say, arranged marriage. Again, remember dynastic marriage, very common in this period. Father chooses the husband. All the women we have come to know, who are they who resist this? Name me some of Shakespearean heroines. Desdemona, good choice here, since she actually chooses the black husband rather than the a darling of the city whom her father Brabantio might prefer. Who else? Imogen, great choice. Good, okay. Even Cordelia. They won't marry Burgundy, King of France instead, and so forth. This doesn't turn on the choice of husband, but the choice of husband is related a little bit to this question of obeying the father and of the father's edict, where the Burgundy changes his mind. You know, election makes not up on these conditions. I won't marry her if the dowry isn't there, but also I won't marry her if her price has fallen. The father doesn't adore her any longer. King of France has a different set of values, let us say, and so he marries her. But so this business about the daughter submitting to the marriage edict of the father or the daughter choosing for herself, again, we're told this in a very vivid way about her resistance to this marriage, and I think you've mentioned both reasons that the play gives us for it. One, that he's an African and that he's other than she, and other also that it's very, very far away. She's leaving Europe in order to make this marriage. And nonetheless, they've all been to the wedding. So it's not as if they've hidden her away. It's not as if this is a kind of arranged marriage, but it's one that's obviously sanctioned and this is where they're coming from. So we could say, you know, part of their problem is that the ship is burdened with, you know, bad vibes because of this forced marriage. But Clarabel, indeed, is way out of the edge of the play. So Clarabel and Sycorax, again, are different kinds of women from the woman that Miranda is. And Miranda is the only woman whom we see. How would you contrast Miranda with Sycorax? How would you contrast Miranda with Clarabel? For Sycorax. Anybody compare them in the play?
Well, the obvious physical differences. I mean, everything that Sycorax is described as being Miranda is the opposite.
Right.
She's young, she's beautiful, she's innocent, she's, you know, she's Oh Brave New World. Whereas I would think if you were contrasting her with Clarabel, you don't have the physical description, but you have the experiential kind of difference, because Miranda has none of this experience of dynastic. I mean, she's about to be made a dynastic marriage. She doesn't realize it.
She doesn't realize it.
But she's that totally innocent of not even having seen human beings before, except for her father and Caliban,
right.
If you...
Right. But you very well show both the disjunction and the conjunction here. In a way, very same thing's about to happen to Miranda. Her father has arranged a suitable marriage for her. He has brought her together with the suitor. He's going to make sure they get married. But we see this production feigned resistance. The father pretends to not wish this in order to test or to create the climate for healthy disobedience or whatever it might be. Have we seen this before in the romances? Have we seen a father pretend to resist the daughter's choice? It is in Pericles, yes. Thais's father, great. Great. What, you remember his name? No. Simonides, which is also the name of a great Greek poet. That Simonides pretends to be angry at the daughter's choice and tells us that he's happy with this, but that he tests her by pretending to be displeased. We get a very much more fully fleshed out version of that in the apparent way in which Prospero feels or seems to feel toward Ferdinand. But Miranda, as you say, is a brave new world, innocent, has not brought up in the court, doesn't have this sense either of parental constraint or of what the, you know, both the dangers and the beauties of the court world. There's a sense in which she is a kind of natural innocent at the same time that she's a natural sophisticate. And when we first see her, the beginning of the play, what is her role? What is her role vis-a-vis her father? What is her role vis-a-vis the shipwreck? Absolutely. If by your art, my dearest father, you have put the wild waves in this roar, allay them. She, again, think about the scene that we saw last week with the clown standing on the shore and watching the shipwreck and having this kind of distanced account of it. It's not that he and his father, the shepherd, don't feel compassion, but it's way out of their control. Shipwreck is one of those things that happens in nature, and all you can do is grieve and pray and move on to the next thing. In this case, however, what's the real story about this shipwreck? It's not a shipwreck. It's a piece of magic. Everybody's clothes are dry. Everybody's alive. It is so much like the real thing that we first encounter it as the real thing. We're in the dark, it's noisy, we hear people shouting and so forth. We don't begin on the shore saying, watch this magic false storm I'm going to create. We wind up in the middle of it, and then we are disabused of its danger as she is. That we are part of that spectatorial moment with Miranda, whose name means what? Wonder. Meaning one Miranda, to be wondered at and to wonder at itself. Now, wonder, major category in the medieval period, in the Renaissance. People collected wonder objects in wonder cabinets. The idea of the natural world and what it can do is full of these objects of wonder, and sometimes they're amulets and wrought things, and sometimes they're things in nature like crystals. But aberrance in nature too. You could say that Caliban is himself a kind of natural wonder in that he looks like a fish as well as like a man and so forth. There isn't an attraction repulsion difference here. These are all wonders in a way. They're all kind of creations of nature. But Miranda is both herself, oh, you wonder, says Ferdinand to her, and admired Miranda, once he learns her name, so that it's underscored for us that he understands both that she is a wonder and that she is a wonderer. She's a great audience, but she's not a wimp. She's not merely the good girl. And the fact that she's not merely the good girl is brought home to us by the fact that she is allowed to rebel against her father, that again she keeps secrets from him, that the capacity for subterfuge, which is a kind of Juliet-like skill and an Imogen-like skill, is also one that she is able to use, so that she's not entirely passive, that her femininity is not entirely a negation of action or power. She has her own mode of action and power. But she begins in the play as this wandering personage, someone who is somehow conflated with the baby that she's described as having been, and with the cherub or cherubim that he describes, the infant angel that he describes her as being, who lifted his spirits when he was set adrift into the boat. But she is, and again, this is characteristic of the way this play is set up, that you've got one example rather than many of a certain type of thing, with the other examples offstage or not immediately available to us, so that Miranda's occupies the only onstage female role, but leads us to ask certain questions about the women who are around the edges of the play and what happens to them. What about Prospero himself. We have held him a little bit at arm's length here in our description of the rest of the cast of characters. How would you characterize him? Yes?
Doesn't Prospero, in fact, control everything and everyone like a chess master? Mm-hmm. At the end, there's that chess game. Mm-hmm. It's almost as though, as the magician, he is the master. He controls everybody. From the beginning, it seemed to be a plan.
From the beginning, it seemed to be a plan, absolutely. And it turns out that even, for example, the courtship is a plan. That what seems to be accidental or a fortuitous circumstance turns out to have been very carefully crafted. Is there any point at which... Yes, go ahead, please.
When he went into his books, it was as though he went into some different place which allowed him then to control reality.
Is there a limit to his power?
Would you say that there is a limit, and that is why he takes the point of view at this point with his daughter's emancipation coming, that he is being freed and he goes on to grow himself in a new way?
What's he going toward?
He's going toward forgiveness of his brother and of himself.
Okay. Is this his own idea? Who suggests forgiveness to him in the play? Yes, please.
Ariel describes how he is moved, I think, to pity.
Yes.
And Prospero replies that it's almost a shame that he doesn't have as strong a reaction.
Right. Dost thou who art but spirit, etc. And am I? I mean, let me see if I can get the lines right. Where Ariel says, you know, mine would, sir, were I human, and. And Prospero says, "And I, mine shall, but I will, in fact, release." This is when he's describing the people in the stinking mire, and Ariel begins to have a sense of pity about this. That there's this kind of transformation from, because this play has the shape of a revenge drama. This is a familiar genre in this period. The long nurtured sense of hurt and injury, finally the culprit comes within your grasp and you're going to do everything you can to disconcert him and to have revenge upon him and to bring him low and even to kill him. And it's a revenge tragedy which, in a different way from Hamlet, but in a related way, averts itself here and becomes something else. Yes, please.
I was just curious about where Prospero's wife was.
Uh-huh.
And the question earlier about what are the limits of his power, he can't make people love or not love. And I was just wondering about, for him, the meaning of the wife not being mentioned, I don't think, in the play. And Miranda's not curious about her mother.
Right. Is the wife ever mentioned?
If it was, I missed it.
There's a.
Well, one point Miranda asks.
Right.
Sir, are you not my father? And he replies, thy mother was a piece of virtue, and she said, thou wast my daughter.
Right. This is very characteristic. We just came out of Winter's Tale, where this issue of the undecidability of paternity, here, it's often a kind of unpleasant witticism of this kind. The very same joke is made by Leonato in Much Ado About Nothing. This very same joke about the sort of the mother said, and it's kind of a boys and boys joke about this. It's a proverbial kind of thing to say. It's coming to the common language. But here's the place in which the mother is mentioned in relation to dynastic succession. And authenticity and legitimacy. Then there's the moment quite late on in the play when Ferdinand is watching the mask. And this is a disputed crux about which there have been interesting things written, where he says, either, so rare a wondered father and a wise makes this place paradise, or so rare a wondered father and a wife makes this place paradise. The question is whether it's the long F, the long S, which is in Elizabethan printing or in Jacobean printing, an S in the middle of a line often has this long tail, or whether it's an F. And you can't really, you can tell, but there's been some dispute about, but in this case he's talking about his own wife, of course, not about Prospero's wife, but it did give rise to a very interesting article by Stephen Orgel called Prospero's Wife about this very question of the absent mother. And of course, absent mothers, as we've noticed, are pretty present in these plays, that most people, except for Coriolanus, have an absent mother, and there's almost always this sort of glance toward it. What do you want to make of this? Do you want to interpret this?
I'm not ready to.
Okay. But one thing it does do is to make her rather like Perdita in the little domestic world of the shepherd and the clown, or indeed like Imogen in among Belarius and Guiderius and Arviragus, the only woman playing the role both of mother and of daughter, or mother and of brother, or whatever role that they think they're playing, that the daughter, mother, wife role is, this is the other woman to Prospero. And indeed, there have been arguments, not mine, but there have been arguments that part of his resistance to other suitors is a kind of incest, that a kind of a desire to keep her for himself. Before we laugh at that too much, we can remember the incest moment, that fleeting incest moment in Act 5 of The Winter's Tale, in which Leontes mistakes his daughter for somebody that he could marry. Yes, please.
The idea of the limits of Prospero's power, it seems to me that it's his power is conditional on the island.
Yes.
That, if he had unlimited power, he could just take off and go take Milan back anytime he wanted to. I mean, he has to make everybody come to him.
Right.
It just seems very interesting, that kind of movement, that everything has to come
right
to him.
Again, the question will, for my kind of reading of the play, since the island and Prospero are versions of the same, that the space is a kind of imagined, the space of his mind in which all these things are happening, there's a certain kind of logic to that. But in any case, he was certainly powerless in Milan. Somebody took his power right away from him, magic or no magic. His magic was not helpful in trying to keep his position in the world. So he was exiled. He didn't choose this. This was not a pleasure trip. This was not a Cunard liner that he was taking to this island where he then decided to stay. This was a place of exile, a place of rejection that he then made into something. And indeed, when he's going to go back to Europe, it is going to be at some cost. What's it going to cost him? Sorry?
Giving up.
Giving up his magic? Giving up? Drowns his books, breaks his staff. Every third thought will be my grave. That he's going back into the world. It's as if he's had this moment of eternal life that is now turning back into suddenly he's going to be an old man. And it's clear that his time is almost over. That he's going back into time, that he's choosing death. It's pathos, but it's not pathos. He's going forward, but going forward means going into death rather than away from it. At this inopportune time, we'll have to stop and take a break. Do come back to these yellow sands after these 5 minutes or 10 minute break. Okay, so let's now take a moment to sort of look at the big picture issues that have marked various strong interpretations of this play, before we then come down to look at some of its textural moments. And I mention this in part because, as I say, if the island is a kind of laboratory for Prospero, so also the play has become a kind of laboratory for various kinds of criticism. It has called forth very different, very compelling, very persuasive modes of criticism. Maybe we can just name some of them to begin with. what would be various critical approaches to this play that you're familiar with?
You need to take the colonial approach.
Okay, great. Let's just list these to begin with, and we'll come back and talk about them. Okay, anything else? Yes?
Metafictional.
Metafictional, splendid. Okay, great. More. That's it? Okay, fine. Let's talk about that. It's crucial.
Well, there's the Prospero is Shakespeare, the kind
of
okay. Play.
Autobiographical, okay. Okay. Anything else? Anything else? I would say that there is both, so to speak, a psychological and a psychoanalytic way of reading this play, and that they are different from one another. Okay. And I think also, probably under colonial, we can put issues like the master-slave dialectic, but discourses of power, I think, and enslavement are things that we might want to talk about slightly adjacent to rather than completely identified with the colonial discourse, because the colonial discourse is to a certain extent a historical reading, and the Fanon's argument about this play, for example, or Manoni's argument about this play would be an argument that combines the psychological, the psychoanalytic, and the power argument to talk about how it is that people get themselves into these relationships of master and slave, or how it is that this is a kind of consent agenda, so to speak, and what kind of a relationship this is. So, all right, this is a good start. We'll get rid of these F's and S's that are confusing us here. This reminds me that there are also quite good feminist readings. Those F's and S's, remember, were part of the Prospero's Wife discourse, that there are quite good feminist readings of this play. And many others. The play, as I say, is because it's so perfect, it really lends itself to many readings of this kind. Pick one out, and let's talk about it for a second. Psychological. Okay. So, how would we distinguish the psychological from the psychoanalytic, just in very, very broad brush terms? Here I feel I must defer to the expert in the room. Anybody have a view about this?
Well, just that broad stroke would be, one would be psychoanalytic would be more unconscious forces as opposed to conscious.
Sure, okay, so I mean, bearing in mind that these are not absolutes, but that psychoanalytic would have to do with unconscious motivations, or the motivations that were somehow not perfectly understood by, or even maybe aggressively misunderstood by, the people who were performing them. There are psychoanalytic ways of reading texts and psychoanalytic ways of reading characters. Psychology of a, again, this is very, no psychologist will agree with me about this, but when we talk about psychological readings of plays, we're to a certain extent talking about character and motivation and the relationships among characters and family clusters and things like that. And a psychological reading of this play then would participate in the conversation that we had a little while ago about the father-daughter tensions, about the sexuality causing an imperfect conversation between them, and deceit or dissimulation, the competition between the father and the suitor, the absent mother, and what this might suggest about the extra roles that are heaped upon Miranda, and the discussion that we had about Caliban too, and whether you can talk about Caliban having a psychology, whether he has a persona that where he has motivations, he has desires, he has relationships, So that, for example, a very, very famous, beautiful passage in which he talks about music, which the Be Not Afeard, the owl is full of noises, sounds, and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. That this is a kind of childlike utterance of that gives you an insight into an aspect of Caliban that seems quite different from the figure of Caliban that you see in front of you. And this figure of Caliban is itself performed in many different ways, sometimes as a kind of hybrid monster, sometimes as a native resident of an island in woven clothing. But the question is sort of what is the interiority of Caliban like? What is the interiority of Prospero like? What are the motivations of these characters? And what's the extent to which, if there is one, that there are more than one father, more than one child in this play, that there's a kind of splitting out of the typical roles of the typical 20th, 21st century roles of generational relationships. The colonial story here is, as you probably know from reading the footnotes in whatever text you're using, embedded a little bit in the history of the time in which the play was written. Remember again that we're always going to pay attention to the time which it's written, the time which it's set, the time which it's performed. And in this case, even though it's not a history play per se, those three things have coincided in the late 20th century to remind people that decolonialization, that colonization were preoccupations in the Elizabethan and early Jacobean period, and also, of course, in the last half of the 20th century, in the beginning of the 21st century, and that the journeys of Columbus, the journeys of Strachey, the journeys of various Captain John Smith, that various of these journeys of exploration that seemed to find a paradise. And then maybe a disease came and destroyed the sailor population, or they were marooned and they either found that it was magical and then found their way back to England. That these stories that seem to be part of the subtextual history of this play are stories that new historicist critics were very interested to find actually reflected and rewritten, or in some kind of conversation with what was going on in these reports of exploration and conquest in the period. Exploration and conquest, which, remember, is part of a kind of nationalist project. It's part of it's the rising capitalism. It's the beginning of a kind of triangular trade in goods and slaves, which so-called civilization is exported and so-called nature is imported and people are part of what's brought back and so forth. But it's also nation building. I mean, all these terms that came back to haunt us ourselves in recent history. It's also a notion of sort of whether this place belongs to us or to the people who live on it but don't deserve to have it because they don't understand it the way we do or whatever it is. So that the allegorization of the colonial moment is multiply written into this play. And the degree to which the play is, so to speak, about Caliban has been at the center of this question about the degree to which the play is colonial. I had a colleague when I first came to Harvard, I came here as a tenured professor, but I was quite young, and I had a very senior colleague who had been teaching this play for years and who was very startled by the then rising tide of colonialist readings of the play, which again then for 15 years became the most common way to read the play. And he said to me one day, he said, if Caliban were the hero of the play, I don't know what the play would mean. And for him, this was completely destabilizing to imagine recentering the play around Caliban and what he had lost and what he might get back. I also saw a production of this play that I believe was directed by Mark Lamos, the same guy who did the Cymbeline in New York, at the Hartford Stage Company Theater, in which Caliban, at the end of the play, remember that there's much stage business about Prospero's magic garment, lie there my art, the art of what thou art, the question of the magic garment that is his part of his magician's apparatus that he will abandon at the end as he drowns his book and breaks his staff and so forth. And in this production, the magic garment lay on the stage, on the island, and Caliban picked it up and wrapped himself in it and began to dance around. And you could see that the whole cycle might be about to repeat itself again, that what Caliban had learned was how to be a colonizer, that what he had learned was how to be a master, how to seek revenge, how to be a figure of power. That in this particular production, what had happened to Caliban was not, I'll be wise hereafter and seek for grace, not this thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine, not this notion of the somehow conversion of Caliban along the way, but in fact a Caliban who stood apart from any reunion at the end of the play, much as Autolycus stands apart from such a reunion at the end of The Winter's Tale, and decides he's going to be himself, but now he's learned how. And that he picked up the magic garment and put it on was in this production a sign of repetition rather than of the end of that repetition. It was, the things had not been redeemed. Maybe they're all the rest of them going back, but here was Caliban about to show what he had learned. You know, he'd learned language, he'd learned how to curse, he'd learned astronomy and so forth. Now he'd learned politics. Now he'd learned colonial politics, he'd learned dictatorship, he'd learned mastery. So this would be one way of making your way through the material of the play. Humanist, I'm so glad you mentioned the notion of a humanist reading of the play. What would a humanist reading of the play be? First of all, what is humanism? Yes, go ahead, please. If you've got an answer to question one, we don't need question two.
I might be simplifying it a little bit. It's sort of Prospero learns the true meaning of Christmas, I guess. You know, he...
I see. Yeah. Well, that's an applied notion of humanism, that he becomes humanized. The humanism in this period is, among other things, a kind of educational movement in the Elizabethan Jacobean period. It's something that is fueled by Italian philosophy. And basically what it does is to put man rather than God at the center of the universe. That the Hamlet's famous speech about what a piece of work of man is man and so forth, which is an echo of Pico della Mirandola's Oration on the Dignity of Man, one of the great humanist documents, is a text that wants, it's not that they forget about God, but they're, you know, when you hear people shaking their hands and their fingers these days and saying secular humanism, this is what they mean, that the idea is that man supersedes God or religion. In this case, it's a restructuring of this image. There's still the idea of man, of God and of the beasts and so forth, but that man, a little lower than the angels here, assumes a more powerful role. And this role was often emblematized on the stage by the figure of the actor, who again was in the Globe Theater situation between the heavens above and the hell below, as the names of these parts of the theater were described and so forth, that this is a very man-centered, human-centered art form. And there's a way in which Prospero, precisely because he doesn't know everything, he doesn't have infinite power only in this one space, he is going to die, he does lose things, he does need to be corrected by Ariel. He does need Miranda's support as a cherubim and so forth, that he is man in the old-fashioned sense of mankind. He's also a man, and this split, now we're going to take a very short but important little detour into deconstruction. You'll have your 5 minutes of deconstruction. That man as the substantive that means all human beings is a word that stands by itself. When you break man into man-woman or man-animal or any other binary in which man is only half of something, so we say man-woman, man-animal, man-god, man-beast, then man becomes not the whole thing, but something in relationship to either the primary partner or the secondary partner, God, man, man, woman. You can tell who's in charge here, so to speak. But Prospero, at various points of this play, is man, and at Prospero, at various points, he is man in a binary relation, And this is structuralism, not deconstruction. But what deconstruction will do is to sort of talk about how that word man then gets emptied out of meaning once it gets broken, so to speak. You see it in tension with itself, that it can mean at the same time all humankind, and it can mean a man, or even that man. And once it does that, you can't put the pieces back together again without remembering that there's this tension within the notion of man. And the play is very good at performing precisely that tension within the notion of man, that there are times when this seems to be a play about mankindness, and there are times when you put Prospero in the frame with Ariel, with Caliban, with Miranda, with Ferdinand, you see his partialness, and you see his lack of impartiality, you see his interestedness, you see his desires, you see his blindnesses, and so forth. And so that, again, the play is brilliant in the way it emblematizes for us both the wish to have a notion of man, empowered man, man, proud man, dressed in his little brief authority, that's Isabella, again, in Measure for Measure, and the idea that man is only actually one of a variety of ways of being a man or a version of mankind. So the humanist reading of the play, so to speak, really begins with this notion of Prospero as all in all and what that means, and also looks at his limitations before the play and after the play, and also his limitations within the play. And those limitations, far from being a flaw in the character, are what make the character an interesting character rather than just an allegorical cutout figure. We've talked a little bit about the feminist reading in that we have talked about what would happen if you focused on the women in the play. And the autobiographical reading, again, I mentioned a while ago because it's so persistent. This is there's so many fantasies that attach to the notion of Shakespeare, including the fact that we can know something about him, that we can know him, that he knows us, that he's scripted us, and the desire to actually have some kind of relationship to Shakespeare. And even, if I can go back to the master-slave for just a second, to have some control over this figure who seems to have some control over us, does play into the way in which this persistent, recurrent notion that this play is about Shakespeare's biography, that he had a daughter who married, that he lost a son, that he was getting old, that he left London, that he went back to Stratford, that he shortly died, and so forth, that the events of the play foreshadow the events in Shakespeare's life or retell the events in Shakespeare's life. This is, again, our cultural desire, I think, to have some intimate connection with Shakespeare, and even to be his heirs, even to be the survivors of Shakespeare and the inheritors of Shakespeare in this way. There's nothing wrong with these desires. There's nothing wrong even with this kind of reading. The fact that it's not historically accurate isn't the end of the story, because the theater is a magic space, and we get out of it partly what we put into it. And so the very persistence of this fantasy or wish or reading or misreading is itself a kind of reading. It tells us a kind of story about the power of the play. And again, and I want really to keep insisting on this, about the simplicity of the architecture of the play, about the way it is reduced to elementals. The island, the man, the half-man, half-something else, the one daughter, the king. And this mention of the chessboard reminds us that there are other places in which these kind of allegorical roles are mentioned even within the play. But the immense simplicity and therefore monumentality of this play is partly what makes it so very great and so very powerful. I asked Larry and Mel if they would be so kind as to introduce a topic into the mix, since we could talk about this play forever. And I think they've been so fabulous within the course that I would like for them to sort of conduct us in a direction. Larry, could you point towards something that you think would be good for us to talk about?
Yeah. Well, something that I think about in terms of the production history of this play is that it sort of is that it's been an occasion for spectacle. And particularly its sensuous elements, its translation, for instance, into opera or into ballet, have been incredibly suggestive. So I think it would be great, for instance, if we would look at some of the songs in it, or perhaps the marriage mask. But all these various theatrical forms that seem to have kind of lent it an incredible durability in production.
Absolutely, right. And this goes along with this issue that I mentioned very briefly at the beginning of the play about whether Ariel is male or female, whether he, she flies or not. There seems to be a really desire to, and Ariel is associated with almost all of these things. He is the entrepreneur of the mask. He is the singer of the songs. Maybe let's look at a couple of the songs to begin with, because they're so wonderful. In Act 1, Scene 2, we have two songs from Ferdinand. And this is the moment that T.S. Eliot was remembering and rewriting in The Wasteland. Can we impose upon you, Larry, to...
I don't have a copy of the text, but anybody else
okay.
You're thinking of Come Unto These Yellow Sands?
Yeah, starting with that, yeah.
All right. Well, I won't sing it, but... Come unto these yellow sands and then take hands, curtsied when you have and kissed the wild waves whist, foot it featly here and there, and sweet sprites the burden bear, hark, hark. Bow wow, the watchdogs bark, bow wow, hark, hark, I hear the strain of strutting chanticleer cry cock-a-diddle-doo.
All right, so this is the first song that Ferdinand hears. Enter Ferdinand and Ariel invisible, playing and singing. Now, this kind of stage direction, which sounds like science fiction, is actually fairly common in the period, that if a character is meant to be, could be wearing a cloak of invisibility, visible to us, not to Ferdinand. Can you interpret this song? What does it seem to be talking about? Who's it addressed to? Come into these yellow sands and then take hands. The audience? Okay, good. Anybody else? I mean, maybe there is nobody else but the audience.
To Ferdinand?
To all the party that came with him? Come into these yellow sands and then take hands. This is, because it's a song and it's an invitation to dance, it is an invitation. It's like a revels moment, you know, the moment at the end of a court mask, when the actors and the audience dance together. This is possible in a court mask because the actors on stage, rather than being ordinary people, are themselves noble men and indeed noble women. So it's not a scandal to touch them or to dance with them because they're social equals. So this is in a way, yes, Larry?
Say a few words about the court mask as a form. You know, where it
sure.
originates historically, what it means, how it's conducted.
I'll try. Okay. So you'll remember that the public theater emerges as an entertainment which is, relatively speaking, democratic in its interests, that apprentices go to the theater, that noblemen go to the theater, that Queen Elizabeth went to the theater, that King James went to the theater, but that it was open access, that there were different levels of payment, and that it was a kind of a rowdy, the public theater was kind of a rowdy place. Plays put on the daytime, different places where you could food sold in the probably in the halls and so forth, and that there were all these kind of anti-theatrical tracts and writings that sort of talked about the dangers of theater, that theater was danger because it impersonated real life, because it made you fall in love with the actors or actresses, because it made you dissatisfied with your own lot, because it was unreligious in that it did, you know, pretend to be images, do what God's supposed to do to make images of man. But also because it was so seductive, and it was seductive even in a very material way, that is to say that apprentices would cut work in order to go to the theater, and that it was also a place, and we're still talking here about the public theater, where when there was plague in the city, it was rampant because a lot of people are stuffed together in this small space and so forth. So this is a kind of performance which is very popular, but also very demotic, very interested in the general populace, and also a place in which, you know, rebellion and revolt might take place. In contradistinction to this, there developed private theaters, indoor theaters, in which, for example, a play like this might be performed. This one is also a play that is performed in a public space. And also court masks, which were extremely popular, especially during the time of King James and James's son, Charles. So we have the Jacobean mask and the Caroline mask. And what this is a case in which there's a collaboration between a poet and a scene designer. The most famous of these collaborations is between Ben Jonson and Inigo Jones, who is a great scene designer, in which Jonson finally writes a poem called An Expostulation Upon Inigo Jones, in which he complains that the stage effects are taking over, that painting and carpentry are the soul of mask. He's extremely unhappy about his words being eclipsed. But the general structure of the court mask is that there is an anti-mask, A-N-T-I mask, which is also an anti-mask, A-N-T-E mask, something that happens before the mask, of something monstrous. There's a mask of blackness. There's a mask of witches that begins with witches and turns into queens. There's a mask of pygmies. Some spectacular, you can imagine a mask of Calibans, you can have plural Calibans, some spectacular image of negativity that then gets transformed or converted by a theatrical exfoliation. It's a literal changing of the stage, the wonderful devices in which what looks like a cave turns into a mountain, what looks like an enclosed space opens up, and so forth. And the characters also, the negative characters disappear, replaced by positive characters who are signs of virtue. And often these masks are very allegorical, and they're figures of harmony, of political success, of pleasure reconciled to virtue is the most famous mask that Jonson writes, and it's about Daedalus and the maze and the idea and the choice of Hercules and the idea that pleasure and virtue can indeed be reconciled. So in this play, we have a mask which is performed, the wedding mask, and indeed the play The Tempest and the play The Winter's Tale were almost surely performed at the weddings, at the wedding of James's daughter, Elizabeth. So here we have a wedding and a wedding mask within a play that is self-performed at a wedding, and itself allegorizes the eternal happiness of the wedded pair, which turned out not to be so happy, but that's another story. And in this mask, the mask of Juno and Ceres, Juno, the goddess of marriage, Ceres, the goddess of the harvest here, combine. Notice that who's the major goddess who's not present in this mask? Sorry? Venus, yes. No Venus, no Aphrodite, no lust. No lust. Instead, we have the marriage and fertility. We have the fruits of marriage rather than the run-up to marriage taking place. And nymphs and reapers happening here. So again, it's fertility, it's nature, and it's a mask that's interrupted, you may remember, by what? By what? Why does he interrupt it? Why does he interrupt it? Yeah. He forgot about the plot that's going on outside there, the plot to murder him, Caliban and the low conspirators, Stefano and Trinculo. My God, we're never going to finish talking about this play. Stefano and Trinculo, who have become who are the low usurpers. These are the butler and the court jester who also came off the ship, who used to be servants in the old world. Now in the new world, they're going to be masters. And Stefano is going to be the new suitor to Miranda, and bring thee forth brave brood, says Caliban, speaking in this wonderful alliterative language that associates him, again, with an older English tradition. That Caliban, having failed himself to become the suitor of Miranda, going to hand her over to this god figure, Stefano, the butler, with his magic potion, which is what? Alcohol. Again, you know, if you know anything about how what happened to native populations, this is a kind of poignant moment here. But Caliban basically gets drunk, ban, ban, ca-Caliban, liberty, liberty, and so forth. Because this is the opposite kind of song from the transformative songs of that Ariel sings to Ferdinand. And so, again, not on the stage with us, but kind of off stage, is this conspiracy against the life of Prospero. The very conspiracy that we talked about when we said that Ariel has them stuck in this stinking mire. But Prospero interrupts the mask right in the middle, and everything disappears. And we have that most beautiful speech in all of Shakespeare, "Our revels now are ended," which is about the revels. It's about the mask. I mean, the word revels here is a technical word that has to do with, I mean, we have, you know, revel, the Christmas revels and so forth, with the which is not unrelated to the notion of revelation, incidentally. But we have this notion that revel means general playing around and having a festivity, and so it does. But the revels were, it was a technical term for what happens at the end of the mask when there's the image of earthly and godly harmony by the actors who are often the family of the audience, because it's a noble audience, a private audience, dancing with the audience. So and again, the image of dancing here from the Elizabethan times to the present, and very poignantly in this play, is the image of earthly and godly harmony. That the music of the spheres, again, why can't we hear Ariel? Because we are fallen. Ferdinand can hear him, but it still seems a little bit strange to him. So this the dance here at the end of the marriage mask is meant to be again an image of earthly harmony modeled on heavenly harmony, and it's the best possible omen for a marriage. But of course, it's interrupted, as it always will be interrupted, because the message of Shakespearean drama is interruption. It's not conclusion. We never get to harmony. You get instead to some kind of realization or revelation or perception. And it's often a memory. It's often something you forgot that then comes back, as Hamlet's father will come to him and say, you know, this is to whet thy almost blunted purpose. Remember me. So the forgotten memory comes back again. And that memory is the human trait. We know this from Nietzsche. We know this from everybody. The memory is the thing that actually makes these characters human. So that the mask at the end, which is an entertainment and would have occupied a lot of stage time and stage space. And every time I've seen it, it's very special. I've seen wonderful versions of this with, you know, 3-foot-high characters. It was a fabulous production at the Chicago Stage Company a couple of years ago. It was just amazing. And I had never been enraptured by this mask before. I'd always thought of it as pages I had to get past in order to get back to the text. But it can be fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. And then you feel as Ferdinand and Miranda did. So what happened to it? You know, this is great. We were in the middle of this. How come we're back in the revenge plot? How come we're back precisely in an older mode of drama? An older mode of drama. I had forgot the filed conspiracy against my life. And we're back in that moment of Prospero wanting revenge. And so we've rolled back not only in terms of atavistic human behavior, but also in terms of the sort of stage history of how certain kinds of plays came to the Elizabethan and Jacobean stage. So the mask is always an image of harmony and slightly an image of timelessness. And it's always, again, going to be interrupted by time. Let's just, before we, now we're going to backtrack to the second song of Ferdinand, because I don't want to leave us with only the one, just to read you this one again, very shortly after the one that Larry read us. Full fathom five, thy father lies, of his bones are coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes, nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs hourly ring his knell. Ding dong, hark, now I hear them. Ding dong, bell. So what's this an image of? It's transformation. Yes, that's step two. Transformation of what?
Death.
Of death. Of death. Yes, we're looking at a dead body underwater. This is an image we're going to see a lot in Shakespeare. You see it in Clarence's dream in Richard III. You see it. There are many places in which this fantasy or this imagination of what it's like to be a drowned person surfaces here. But here, again, immediately, you're quite right, it turns into transformation, sea change, that to suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. And this notion of the sea change could be, again, lifted from this play and talked about as the way in which Shakespeare makes metaphor, the way in which Shakespeare makes characters, the way in which he makes drama, that it seems to be natural, but also it's kind of magical. Bear in mind that this is a fiction, that his father is not dead. That we are relieved to find the transformation, the dead body is already turning into natural life again and pearls, so that we have both jewels, coral and pearls, and also, you know, new creatures. But also we have ultimately the sense that this is a fictive event, that he has got to, Ferdinand comes to terms with death imaginatively and in the bounded space of a song so that he can begin to think of himself as fatherless, and therefore as man, as the king of Naples, as a figure with a future. And he needs to go through this death of the father. This would be to go back to the psychological or psychoanalytic reading. He needs to go through the death of the father imaginatively so as to be able to re-encounter his father alive again at the end of the play as a different person, and in the meantime to have conducted, as he does, in an extremely elegant as well as arduous way, his courtship of Miranda. Because again, what he does is, of course, to take over all the jobs that Caliban had, the carrying of the wood, the being the slave, and so forth. But he is not the slave, he is the servant. And he animates that word servant out of the Petrarchan discourse, in which the lover is the servant of the beloved, in which everything he does is at her servant, in which this language of servant and mistress is the completely common language and the completely common practice. And he talks about the fact that the mistress that he serves makes all his trials pleasures. The purposelessness, so to speak, of the enslavement of Caliban here becomes purposeful, and the notion of slavery is set aside again in favor of this notion of the servant. So, you have more, Larry, that you want us to talk about the mask?
I think that was great.
All right. Mel, please.
Really? Because you know what I'm going to want to talk about. But I want to offer the students a chance to chime in, too, though, because in all seriousness, my voice has been pretty forward on the discussion board this week. I've kind of been still stuck back on Antony and Cleopatra haranguing on that, so... Should we open it up for student questions?
Okay.
Or
okay.
Because otherwise I'm going to want to talk about despair and everyone will leave here all dreary, and we right. certainly don't want to leave a tempest on
right.
that note. Should we talk a little bit about it? As long as we just don't leave it on that note, I don't want to
right.
well, send
so,
everyone
so let me,
out
let
of
me
here.
Say, we got 10 minutes,
okay.
And I think we probably need to talk about Prospero's various farewells. Because I would not want to say farewell to you without taking note of the fact that this is a guy who says goodbye for half the play. That you know, he's like an old actor. You cannot really get him off the stage, and he begins rehearsing his departure quite early on. Our revels now are ended. Again, a magnificent speech, and we can read it together. What are his other farewells? What? Sorry?
There's an epilogue.
There is an epilogue, absolutely. There's the epilogue, and between that, there's the moment that we talked about before in which he abandons his magic. The ye elves speech in which he drowns his book, in which he abandons his magic, that this is another kind of farewell. It's important, I think, that he keeps... leaving and not leaving, that he keeps articulating his losses, that he and that in each of these spheres he says goodbye to art, he says goodbye to magic, he says goodbye to his daughter, he says goodbye to the island, he says goodbye to life. What doesn't he say goodbye to? He says goodbye to Ariel. Go chick. Farewell. Caliban is the one thing that he doesn't say goodbye to. This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine. That there, you know, whether or not you see them going off into the ether together, there's a sense in which the release is also an act of claiming. That and this is and the I acknowledge mine is different from, but also importantly similar to that moment that we looked about before in which we hear that the mother said that you were my child and I believe her. That's a kind of mine, I acknowledge mine moment. This is a very different I acknowledge mine moment. I think we don't fantasize that this is his actual physical child. So how do we understand that moment of Caliban being acknowledged? Acknowledged, such an important word. Yes. In what sense?
Prospero molded Caliban's character. He taught him things that he chose to teach him.
Right.
And so he is very much a creature of Prospero.
And he's responsible. He's responsible that the deformation of Caliban is not a physical deformation, though he's described at some points in this way, but that he is formed and then he is deformed by the paternal law, by the first the teaching of language, the humanization, and then the dehumanization, by the refusal of the courtship and by the enslavement. And so, yeah. The withdrawal of love, yes, yes, exactly. But first he gives it, and then he takes it away. So that the Isle Full of Music speech is really a speech about love. I mean, it's a speech about the access to identification and to going outside yourself and so forth. And because Caliban feels loss, and he doesn't only feel loss of Miranda. He feels a more profound kind of loss. Exactly.
It's just heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. Absolutely. And I mean, all of these figures encounter loss. But Caliban, in a way, incarnates it. He is both one who has lost and one who allegorizes loss and one who cannot be lost because he is indissoluble from the Prospero, who is going forward. Yes.
Can I jump in a little
Please.
Bit on this point now? To me, it's a very powerful thing as well because I'm reading it through the lens of Prospero setting himself up a good death. And it's not that that is what the play is trying to function, but it's appropriating all the forms that people used to use in order to itemize their existence and say goodbye to it and bequeath certain things so that there's a stock taking. You know, as he says, every third thought will be on death. Some of you may be familiar with the idea that in the Renaissance, if death took people by surprise, this was a terrible thing, and it was not indicative that you were headed toward a good place. So that they were very obsessed with the idea of getting everything in order, conscience-wise, material-wise, and this is sort of the form of what he's doing at the end. And so therefore, it's all the more tragic and heartbreaking that Caliban seems to have no place in his thoughts as he's ordering what's most important to him as he's getting ready to go to the next realm, whether that's on earth through death, whatever next imaginative realm is coming for him. Caliban doesn't have any place in his sense of leave.
This is why this production that I saw that left Caliban on the stage is like the famous Peter Arnold cartoon about the Noah's Ark and the unicorn. You remember, anybody see this? It's an old New Yorker cartoon in which completely heartbreaking cartoon. You'll understand what I mean in a second. Huge storm going on, and over in the distance you can see on the horizon is this ark just disappearing. And here you are on the edge of a piece of island landscape, and there's a unicorn looking at... No, exactly! Looking out at the disappearing ark. And, you know, wow. So it's, but it's that image of the unpartnered, unique, fabulous, and unsaved figure. And it's the perspective from that look. I mean, again, it's meant to be a cartoon, but actually, you know, philosophy. So, all right, the let's talk about the epilogue for a second, just one second. That just to say that it, I mean, like all epilogues, it is epia. It comes after the play. Epilogue, speech after something. And that it is a much less powerful piece of poetry in some ways than some of the speeches that Prospero is given within the text. I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to read the rebel speech, and then I'll let you go till after Christmas. Here's the epilogue spoken by Prospero after he has let Ariel go. And remember the struggle that he has to let Ariel go. And if Ariel is imagination and invisibility and creativity and so forth, he grounds his book, he breaks his staff, and this is, of course, an echo of Medea the witch in Ovid. He lets Ariel go, and then he is alone on stage. Exeunt omnes, everybody else leaves. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have is mine own, which is most faint. Notice that the caesura in the middle of the line emphasizes that. The line stops in the middle. Now 'tis true, I must be here confined by you. Who are you? Audience, okay, confined, as Caliban was confined, here, on the stage, by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardoned the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell. So who's the magician now? Audience. But release me from my bands with the help of your good hand. So what's being asked for here? Thank you. Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails. Which was to please. Again, watch the caesuras here. Watch the halts in the middle of the sentence. Now I want. Want in what sense? Lack. Might be desire, but it's also lack. Lack and desire at this point in this play are the same. Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes with pardon be, let your indulgence let set me free. And here again a kind of echo of the notion of a religious indulgence as both a high and a low notion. So this is Prospero to the audience. Now I'll take you back to Act 4, Scene 1, which is Prospero only to Ferdinand, really. And again, it's this speech so often taken out of context that we forget that it's actually spoken just to his putative son-in-law. You do look, my son, this is Act 4, Scene 1, line 4, 146. You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir, our revels now are ended. So, be cheerful, our revels now are ended. How often do we quote those two lines together? These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant we've just seen, faded, leave not a rack behind, not a wisp of cloud. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. This is the classic passage. It's the middle of the speech. Sir, I am vexed. Bear with my weakness. My old brain is troubled. Be not disturbed with my infirmity. If you be pleased, retire into my cell and there repose. A turn or two I'll walk to still my beating mind. So here we have sublimity returning into drama. We have this passage that speaks more wisely than it knows about endings and about the artifice of drama and the way dreams are reality. speaks about the ambitions of the theater and about what it can do for us. And then the speech draws right back into the humanity and frailty of the actor and the character and his beating mind. And that beating mind that we saw in Lear on the Heath, that beating mind in which there's a kind of pulse in the mind that is so painful that he's aware of himself thinking, and that's what makes it so intolerable for him. The play will always return into the human from the sublime. There are these glimpses of dream. This, what happens in this speech for us is what happened to the mask and Ferdinand. And we're in the position of speaking to the dismayed and discomfited Prospero and perceiving that what is temporarily at bay here is just an aspect of the same kind of theater that is here represented by the figure with the dismay and the walking into the cell and the beating mind. And it's that frailty in him that is finally the most recognizable aspect of the play. Our little life is ended with a sleep. I'll see you on the 2nd of January. Have a great holiday.